suggestions, your joint suggestions, were very pertinent, I think, and we can respond along that line. But we depend on you to do what you'd like.
Okay, let me start then. I'm Jeffrey Sturcio, and with me today are Dr. Marcy Goldstein and Dr. William O. Baker, Chairman Emeritus of Bell Laboratories. We're interviewing Dr. Baker today, May 23rd, 1985, at the Murray Hill headquarters of AT&T Bell Labs. Dr. Baker, we know you were born in Chestertown, Maryland in 1915, but we really don't know much else about your family background. I wonder if you could just start by telling us a little about your parents, what they did, what kind of background they had.
Well, they were from New York City, where their folks had lived for a century and a half or so, and therefore found an expedition into an old plantation on the Eastern Shore rather startling, and they took great pleasure in learning how to grow the things that one did in the plantations of Eastern Shore Maryland in those days, and then they eventually got more practical, or perhaps more inventive about what they wanted to do, and they really concentrated on the technology of fowl production, and my mother in particular laid the basis for the broiler industry, which is now, through Mr. Perdue and others, a very fashionable element of the Eastern Shore. They created the first wire platforms on which these birds were matured very quickly. Of course, they didn't have the chemistry and biotechnology, which is presently the result of presently the cause of these very rapid maturings, very efficient productions of chickens and turkeys. Then they got, my mother in particular again, got very interested in turkeys and raised the first flock of 1,000 that anybody had been so wild as to cultivate in this country, and from 1,000 domestic turkeys is a large lot. Since then, that's been multiplied many times. But found that there were interesting developments that could be undertaken to improve the culture of turkey raising. And I was written a couple of books about this, but particularly for your point, collaborated with Professor Ernest Edward Tizer at Harvard, who was a leading pathologist of his time, and with the Merck laboratories here in New Jersey to apply therapy to some of the worst diseases which had kept turkey production very low, very inefficient for years. And one of these was called coccidiosis, another was called Blackhead. And this involved the administration through a catheter about a meter long of colloidal iodine, which Tizer had found was about what you had to use. And the Merck people produced this colloidal iodine, powerful stuff. And I report all this because it was my earliest exposure, I think, to systematic chemistry. I helped them administer this. It had to be done bird by bird for thousands. These things, and we did it, you see. And this was really quite a remarkable phenomenon. Not what you would select as the most elegant or most easy or efficient kind of therapy. And, that was.
When was that?
This was in the 1926 to 33 period. There are movies made of this, by the way. Newsreel has shown these administration of these catheters, and our flocks were stabilized by those, and it's been reported in the National Geographic and other journals. But it was perhaps pertinent to your kind of question because it indicated a certain exposure to the more bio-oriented aspects of chemistry.
My father was
also very interested in minerals and had a small mining operation in North Carolina for a while, so I got pushed, or at least attracted a little bit toward the inorganic side.
Would Was that around the same time when you were
That was a bit, it was around the same time. It was perhaps a bit earlier. I was 15 in 1930. Well, I was pretty well involved in this owl culture by then, but he had gotten fairly well past the mining and minerals effort.
Just for the record, what were your parents' names?
Harold and Helen. Helen and Harold.
It's interesting to learn those kinds of influences that may have steered you either consciously or subconsciously toward a career in science at that time. Did you have any, say, secondary school teachers who had an influence on you in that regard? I mean, what other kinds of influences were there?
Well, secondary school teachers, and incidentally, some of this has been recorded up in one of these issues of Chemical Engineering News that discusses career developments. And also a fellow wrote up some of this. I get that out in case you want it. It was published, published in the papers. But in secondary school, there was a modest influence of a man named Creasy, who was the principal of school and taught chemistry. Was a good old Pennsylvanian who had firm convictions that you ought to learn something about the periodic table and do the formal things of chemistry of those times. Wasn't discouraging, it wasn't exhilarating, but it was adequate. There was a mathematics teacher, I think of the name, who was perhaps more compelling and really very diligent indeed, and one developed a considerable interest in mathematics stage.
Did at the time you were leaving high school, it must have been the depths of the Depression.
Yes,
1931-32.
It's pretty deep, all right.
How did did you always plan to go on to college? How did things look?
In a general sort of way. I mean, it always seemed like there were lots more to be learned than I had learned. So I thought one had to keep running after it. My parents felt that way too.
Had they both had college education?
No, they were fairly well informed, very wide readers. I say my mother, two books on her subject, but they didn't go through the formalities. Of course, New York education at that stage was fairly constructive, fairly dependable, and public system.
And you went on to Washington College, which was nearby.
Yeah.
Could you tell us something about your college years?
Well, Washington College performed a very interesting role. We looked at it more rather practically this way. It was a transition between the secondary school and college in the more effective or broader sense. It was somewhere between preparatory school and university. We looked at it as an opportunity to have a broad exposure to learning, and I've always been extremely grateful for that. This is another way of saying that science in the college was not extensive enough to displace a lot of liberal arts as well, and I've been very grateful for that one. But we had a very distinguished woman in English literature, a couple of people follow her, Davis in German literature, some excellent people in math, and very good opportunities, therefore, to postpone the very demanding dimensions of science as it was coming on in chemistry, and acquire some liberal arts, which, as I say, I've been enormously grateful for.
When did you decide to major in chemistry, or did you major in chemistry?
Oh, I think the first day I went to college, but there was an excellent professor there, Buxton, who had been a student of Moss at McGill. Moss, probably remember, he was a kind of disciple of Rutherford, who discovered the structure of the atom. McGill was then a center. Rutherford had been there for some years, and Moss was a pioneer in physical chemistry, and Buxton was one of his very good students. so I got into that right away.
So you, so he excited your interest in this. What kind of laboratory facilities were there? I mean, what kind of introduction to research did you get in those years?
Research was vanishingly small. The laboratories were entirely adequate. They were small, but it was a very small group, and they were very, there was lots of room, and we had plenty of time. So we did all the conventional experiments and hands-on experiments, and Buxton was just very good. He had assistants. Mrs. Harley, who was a very diligent person, and she was very good at analytical chemistry, which of course is basic in those times. There was a pretty good physicist. He wasn't much interested in chemistry, but he was complimentary to it. A man named Cook, who I think is still alive, and headed the naval research work at Johnstown Naval Laboratory for a number of years after he left Washington College.
Just as an aside, at this time, were you or your colleagues aware of the formation of Bell Labs? And this was kind of all getting underway. Was this something people talked about or noticed?
That's a very good point, Marcy. The laboratory is known to us through their rather extensive educational and public affairs programs. Now, this, I should have to reconstruct a couple of these names for a moment. This became more clear through the neighbor who came along when I was perhaps halfway through Washington, who was owned an independent telephone company, had just retired from it, but he owned it and formed it up in near Erie, Pennsylvania. And this fellow, like so many of the independents, was absolutely lyrical about the Bell system and about the Bell Laboratories. Of course, their whole structure at that stage, when these independent companies were proliferating all over the country, was entirely dependent on Bell Laboratories' technology. And this fellow was utterly, he was a very intelligent chap, and he was utterly committed to the idea that the Bell Laboratories was a great source of progress in the world. And so he convinced us further that this was something worth listening to. By the time we had gone further, I'd say perhaps junior or something like that, in college, we were really very much oriented toward the Bell system, Bell Laboratories. Our first telephones in this old plantation area were independents, and they were operated by a fellow named Schoon, who came around with a screwdriver and put things together, and it worked extraordinarily well, considering that some of the transmission line was on wire fences, but you couldn't have pole. You see, you can do that on the ground element of it if you have a pole that has one major wire line. But the CNP company moved in, acquired that company as the others about the time we were about junior year or something in college, and so we began to see the field operations of part of the Bell system quite early. And they began to have talks in the area, too, as they always do.
It's very interesting. This gets to a question, or broaches a subject that I wanted to move to, which is when you were graduating from Washington College, I just wondered what your plans were at that time, what kind of career you anticipated, what job prospects there were.
Yeah, there weren't many jobs. They had vanished. But we were very much committed to graduate study and further study, realizing that, as I say, the college had a kind of intermediate position here, although Buxton was actually the first rate, but there just wasn't an opportunity for the depth of study that you would have at a Berkeley or other place. You know, pursuing chemistry vigorously in those days.
So you had always, while you were in college, planned to go on to graduate work.
Yeah.
What was it that attracted you to Princeton?
We gave this a great deal of thought, of course, and Buxton, of course, was a primary factor, but we had other discussions with people, and it seemed to represent an extraordinary opportunity for frontiers of what you'd call a new chemistry at that point, which is physical chemistry, without being lost in a very large operation. Now, as you brought out so nicely in the Beckman biography, did you come see that clip, that film that they put together? It's great. You see that sometimes. It's very, very good. This was for Beckman's birthday a couple of a month or so ago that we had Rockhorn. Illinois and Berkeley and Harvard in its particular ways and a few other places were growing very fast, and Johns Hopkins, of course, had had graduate work to read. Buxton, by the way, before he went to McGill, had graduated from Clark, which was a graduate university at that stage, and all these places led us to think, well, it would be very good to have the advantage of the new American wave in chemical research and teaching, but it would also be very good to maintain some individuality and personal identity. And Princeton seemed to be a combination of those elements. Now, it was also on the physical chemistry side. It was also very attractive because of the physics, and of course, it had been preeminent for many years. Compton, in his time, he had since gone to, had by the time I got there, gone to MIT as president, but he had done very distinguished work there. The work on electron emission, Richardson, which Richardson won the Nobel Prize, and had a brilliant student named Davison, who was not unknown to us. See, the discovery of electrons or waves had been done by Davison and Germer here before I actually had to choose a place. But then Bush's, well, the general interest in advanced chemistry as a derivative of physics and of the older organic discoveries, Germany, which, as I say, were being pursued largely in Hopkins, that convergence came along. Lauder Jones had gone to Princeton from Chicago, brought some of the organic work. I, at that point, no great inclination toward organic chemistry, but I was interested in it, and Hugh Taylor had attracted a lot of Buxton's other modern chemist's attention by his treatise. Well, you ever saw this, but the treatise on physical chemistry, which wasn't all written by him. He pulled a lot of other distinguished people together, but Taylor, you see, was an Englishman who had a very cosmopolitan view of science, which was not so prevalent at Illinois and California and even Caltech or the group in those days. And this was another attractive feature because the German, I had, as a matter of fact, had we give very serious thought in answering your question further to going to Germany, and I had won a modest scholarship in German from, it was given by the German ambassador von Prittnitz and Kaffron. And this was presented, this was before I graduated from Washington, but I was very interested in German, and so I was quite prepared to go and study there. But the fact that Nazism was beginning to stir was very disturbing, and the fact that Taylor at Princeton seemed to have a great feeling of linkage with the European chemists resulted in that.
Indeed, Taylor, a number of people came over as postdocs in the period of the mid-30s, so that there was a lot of interchange on that level as well at Princeton.
Yes.
Well, I was going to ask you some specific questions that you've already answered about the character of the Princeton department. It was, as I recall, the entire graduate school was only about 200 students at that time. So that it really
yes,
was a very small...
It might have been 300, but it wasn't more than that. That's right.
And although the chemistry department was the largest graduate
yes.
department in student body, there were only about two dozen graduate students.
That's right. Oh, you're so, right. And you see, that was another very attractive thing, coming back to this point about individuality. And Princeton had this unique graduate college for residents, which you may have visited. I guess you both have visited. It's one of the great, I think, structures in this country, and it permitted a lot of interchange, just along the lines you're saying, with other science, which interested me a lot, and so I liked it for that reason, too. Yeah.
What, this, well, when you started at Princeton in the fall of 1935, I believe it was, that was a very lively time for the intellectual activity in the Princeton Chemistry Department. Eyring's paper on the activated complex and chemical reactions had just been published a few months earlier. There was Taylor's research on catalysis and other research going on in kinetics, Smythe's work on dielectrics. How did all of this impress you when you started in the fall of 1935?
With awe, for one thing, because I was approaching this, you see, from a semi-finished view. I recognized that Washington was a preparatory venture, and therefore was determined to get through undergraduate as well as graduate work at Princeton, which I did. And the levels of sophistication which one was surrounded there were really quite compelling. Plus the fact that you're absolutely right in your assessment of the empire, plus the fact that my colleagues who were entering people were such people as Stevenson from Berkeley, who had stood at the top of their college of chemistry. See, G.N. Lewis had set up this college. He wasn't satisfied with the department of Mars. He had a college of chemistry, which still exists out there. And Stevenson was his top student, you see. So here I was thrown up against these fellows who had years of intense chemistry, whereas I had years of German mathematics and other things. I had long something reasonable about chemistry. So I would say that awe was probably the appropriate term.
What, could I just ask you about your interactions at that point with people like Hugh Taylor or Henry Eyring? What were Taylor and Eyring like to an entering graduate?
Well, they were demigods. Well, Taylor enjoyed that role. Eyring exercised that role in rather amusing form. I use the right word, demigod, because Eyring thought that the one thing he could do is to save the souls of chemists as well as eliminating these Mormons of very great conviction. And he, as Fletcher, of course, was here. He and Fletcher were colleagues. But this is a slightly flip way of answering, but an accurate one. You're a very good question, Jeff, because Taylor was a classic English university person who was quite remote and dignified and at the same time very demanding of the students. Eyring was an evangelist who felt that he had, a finger on the future of chemistry and science by not only the activated complex but the whole introduction of quantum mechanics and quantum statistics. Both of which are being approached very tentatively. Pauling, of course, had done his elegant work with Wilson. Wilson, a graduate of Princeton earlier, and had worked, a graduate work a little with Smythe. So this influence was there, you see, that somebody needed to bring it forward, and the hiring brought it forward. Now, I don't want to overbore you with this.
Oh, no,
thing,
please.
But, these people were clearly creating a frontier, which was, of course, what we had dreamt of and hoped that it would be found. But there was, just as you say, so much stir, so much excitement, that we had to run very hard to keep up with it.
One has the impression in reading, well, of course, when I've read Taylor's accounts of chemistry at Princeton at the time, I've read material on Eyring, so one would expect to get the impression that the physical chemists were really in control of the department. Was that really an accurate way of...
Absolutely. The days of Laura Jones have long since passed. Now, the other compelling feature that you all very thoughtfully brought out a bit ago is that Princeton was a ferment of scientific activity then, and this residence at the Graduate College really made this hit a neophyte like myself right in the head. R.H. Fowler was there. This was all I was just starting, you see, and I was really getting going in these things. Fowler is the creator of modern statistical mechanics. Fowler's book, which is about that thick, was revolutionizing chemistry, metallurgy, physics, on how you use quantum statistics for describing great assemblies of things, which previously they thought you had two atoms, you had too many, you see, and you're followed up with it. Von Laue was there for a couple of years on partly the institute, partly the university, the father of structure analysis and of X-ray scattering. The Bohr group in Copenhagen were richly represented, as I'll mention to you later. We were there when fission was discovered, and Bohr called a seminar to look into it right away. You'll see that evening, which I'll never forget. These are simply examples, like I could bore you with great many more, of how these things were interacting, and they led to great expectations for chemistry, because we were, I took spectroscopy from Van Vleck, who was visiting from Harvard. I took spectroscopy from Turner in the physics department, who was one of the leading spectroscopists. I sat in on the seminars of Henry Norris Russell, who was the pioneer in astrophysics and determined the spectral transitions, the chemical transitions in the stars, you see. So that everybody expected chemistry to live up to this, to become another great frontier in learning. And this is how Eyring and Taylor and Webb. Webb was a fascinating case. His research was trivial, but Webb's pedagogy was superb. And he wrote a book right while I was there on the first year on physical chemistry, which was the most elegant junction of classical physical chemistry, the Jean Louis Nernst era of thermodynamics and kinetics, with the new quantum statistics and quantum mechanics of Eyring and of Pauling. So we were right in the midst of that. Webb was, I tell you, a very incisive character whose ability to create examinations and evaluate them was unsurpassed. T.J. Thomas Jefferson Webb. But this was a very interesting sociology, because you had people like him who were extremely demanding of tests and concepts and pedagogy, and then you had Eyring and Pease and others who were pushing the understanding, the frontiers, you see. And they didn't pay so much attention to these pedagogic formalities, because they were making theory obsolete by tomorrow. And this is exactly what our course is doing.
Let me, as long as we're on, you mentioned a couple of the courses that you took. Here's the description of the catalog courses in the Graduate Department of Chemistry for 36-37. I just wonder if you could mention the sorts of things within the chem department that you were doing.
Oh, yes, and blessings on you for digging this out, because we took these all, and these things now, just run down the list here. The physical chemistry was based on his treatise. It was the view of the frontier. Pease, on the other hand, was a plodding but extremely effective, and his son worked for us for a number of years, lived down the road here, I don't know anymore. Extremely competent measures, experimental work on gas kinetics, fundamentals of hydrocarbon reactions. Webb is this fellow I've just been talking about. He's the thermodynamics and chemical reactions man here, and the whole emphasis was on pedagogy. It says 12 problem sets required. Well, it only took a couple of days to do one problem, you see, so there were 12 problem sets. And then he taught statistical mechanics. Now, he was a good interpreter for Eyring, because he's very rigorous, and what he said here about Fowler and Darwin were well applied. Darwin is the son of the evolutionists who's the son of this Darwin, worked with us here for a few years in switching research with Deming Lewis. His father was director of the National Physical Laboratory, and is the Darwin who created some of these techniques for statistical mechanics. But this Fowler is R.H. Fowler, who's really, when you look at the physical chemistry of today and the routine statistical mechanics we apply there, you'll find the roots of it back in this fellow's book. So Webb was an interpreter. Eyring was the evangelist indeed, and his quantum mechanics and chemistry just roared along with absolutely minimal organization, minimal pedagogy. You had to keep lurching ahead to get any, even keep up with him. He'd have a new theorem or a new finding or explanation of the reaction of hydrogen with iodine every day, and they were very exciting. Like, a fellow named Smith and I did a fundamental first principles calculation of the dipole moment of HCl on the basis of Eyring's charge distribution analysis, you see, of very simple chemical bonding. there. But this is sort of thing.
For readings for that course, I'm particularly interested in Eyring's work on quantum mechanics at that time. Was there a text that you were using, or were you going straight from the original papers? And
we had to go for the papers. Eyring just couldn't be bothered with the text, you see. Now, Eyring did have a text with Kimball on statistical mechanics with George Kimball, who became professor at Columbia and was there for a great many years. George Kimball was about, Eyring at this point was maybe 38 or something like that. George Kimball was maybe 28. He was a decade or less younger than Henry. And Henry always referred to him as old George Kimball.